I'm Jordan Abel, Director of Public Programs at the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco, and I welcome you to BINA, KALW's program featuring creative voices from the JCCSF. In this series, we bring you remarkable artists and thinkers who've come to speak at the JCCSF as part of our Arts and Ideas program. On this edition of BINA, our guest is founder of the design firm IDEO, David Kelly. He's joined in conversation by Douglas McGray of Pop-Up Magazine and the California Sunday Magazine. And now join Lenore Naxon on stage at the JCCSF as she introduces David Kelly and Douglas McGray.
David Kelly was working unhappily as an electrical engineer when he first heard about Stanford's cross-disciplinary joint program in design, which had merged engineering and art. What he learned there, a human-centered, team-based approach to tackling sticky problems through design, propelled his professional life as a design thinker. In 1978, David Kelly co-founded the firm that ultimately became the award-winning global design firm IDEO. IDEO created many icons of the digital generation. The first mouse for Apple, the first Trio, remember those? The thumbs up, thumbs down button on your TiVo's remote control. But what matters even more to him is unlocking the creative potential of people and organizations so that they can innovate routinely. In his new book, Creative Confidence, he advises that creativity is about believing in your ability to make change in the world around you. It is the conviction that you can achieve what you set out to do, and that this self-assurance, this belief in your creative capacity, lies at the heart of innovation. David's most enduring contributions to the field of design are a human-centered methodology and culture of innovation. More recently, he led the creation of the groundbreaking D-School at Stanford, the Hasso Plattner Institute of Design. Today, David Kelly serves as the chair of IDEO and is the Donald W. Whittier Professor at Stanford, where he has taught for more than 25 years. He's here tonight with his new book, Creative Confidence, in conversation with Douglas McCray, the editor-in-chief of the California Sunday Magazine and Pop-Up Magazine, the thing to which I wish I could get a ticket, but they're always sold out. Please join me, ladies and gentlemen, in welcoming David Kelly and Douglas McCray to the JCCSF.
So on page 97,
I remember it well. You know, the...
you have the header begins interview techniques.
Yeah. Are you sure that's true?
I took a special interest in this page. It was actually, and I'm not making this up. When I first got the book, I opened it, just opened it to the middle. And I actually opened it to this page and folded the corner to make sure that I didn't forget that. But what it says is actually that talking to people and interviewing is a little bit overrated.
Yeah, I think, you know,
don't tell them that. I think they paid to come in. We're here.
We use lots of interviews. I mean, interviews are enlightening, but we're trying to uncover non-obvious needs that people have and then satisfy them. It's mm-hmm. the way we innovate, right, is we try to understand what's meaningful to people. And if you ask people that, their responses are so full of their filter. You know, it's like you're really talking to their representative, not to them. You know, they're in their whatever, they're putting their best foot forward, so to speak, whatever they think that is. And we're trying to get behind that, right? So observation is much more enlightening. If you watch somebody if we're trying to help somebody improve a piece of software, if you watch them, and it's a new piece of software, right? So they're grimacing most of the time that they're using it and they're having trouble. And then you ask them, you know, how was it? they say, oh, it's great, or it's fine, right? Because they're trying to show you that they were, you know, smart enough to be able to figure it out, right, or something. But all you really have to do, if you watch those grimaces and then just record those and match the software to that, it was that, it's that thing. My first time was that when we kind of started doing this service that we call Human Factors, what we call human-centered design, but Human Factors is the discipline of these people who are kind of like anthropologists to do it. And I'm with one of the young anthropologists, and we're trying to help Pepsi, I think it was, design a new vending machine. You know, we go to Japan, see how, because they're cool, and they are really hip on vending machines and stuff. And we're standing there watching this person use a machine, and I'm an engineer, right? And so I'm looking at it, I can't see, I mean. And she says, do you think it's right that the Pepsi comes out at your ankles? Right? Well, I never saw it. So it's, you need to develop a way of looking that's this kind of this open-minded, you know, way of looking. And you know, you sit there for a while, and it was so obvious that people are like on their knees with their arms up in the machine, and you're getting a good view of their behind, you know, as they're like, so anyway, so.
So maybe we should just observe you for a while. You can just forget we're here.
Well, if you observe me in my habitat, if you were in my studio or you were at Stanford, you would learn a lot about me or a professor or whatever when you watch them. I mean, you ever had that in a restaurant and you look across the room and you see somebody and you say, I don't know them, but I don't like them. You know, like, your history, your intuition has been informed by your experience in that way. And so we're actually quite good at it. My mentor, Bob McKim, who started the program at Stanford, said to me a long time ago, a fish doesn't know he's wet. And that's, it sounds silly, but it's kind of profound. I realized that, you know, the stuff that's right around us, it's familiar to us, we can't see it.
And was this obvious to you in the beginning when you were getting into design? It seems when you see the work, it seems to make so much sense. But this wasn't always the way people did things.
No, the design profession is really it's really gone through a transformation, which has been fabulous for us, for Stanford and IDEO, and for people that are like minded with us. Is that design had always been kind of like a primarily about aesthetics and about an individual kind of thing, the talent of the artist, sort of, and that was great, and that still exists. But design has moved to what we're calling design thinking, where it's a team sport, and it's about how you routinely innovate. How do you come up with new ideas that benefit the world? And so that's really expanded our role. I mean, I'd have to say, especially at Stanford, I've been there actually 35 years, and for the first 25... I felt like I was kind of at the kids' table, you know, like, and if the president of the university came down, he was coming down to say, where do you get shoes like that, you know, or you know, design questions, right, in that way.
Maybe a business card redesign.
Yeah, exactly. And now they're looking for designers to solve the biggest, most important problems that the university has. We're working on, you know, K-12 education, but we're also working on helping the university would like every Stanford student to be confident in their creative ability. Yeah.
So take us back to when you started IDEO. Was this thinking in the air already, or was it set the stage? What were you seeing out there in the design world and the world of people who hired them?
Yeah. So design was, you know, we're talking about people like Charles Eames and Raymond Loewy and people who really were talented and doing great things, but I wasn't, you know, all things happen because of some kind of insecurity or deficiency in the person starting the thing, I think. And so I wasn't that talented, you know. So it was hard to compete with those guys. But what I really liked doing was making raving fans of the person that, you know, who it was designed for. So, and we started out doing things for blind people, and we started out doing things that... you know, for like empowering nurses and stuff like that. And so it was just so, you're a nerdy engineer, and to see some human light up by something you've done was that way. But so the design profession was primarily around what at that time was called industrial design or graphic design or all those kind of things. And I certainly had all my heroes were those kind of guys. Paul Rand is a graphic designer, and Ettore Sottsass is an industrial designer. And so I graduated from Stanford, and I was more like a hybrid engineer who appreciated design, right? And so I decided pretty early on that this was going to have to be a team sport for me, where design prior to that time was an individual sport. You could name the person who was the head of the firm. You know, you named the architect, and everybody else kind of was subordinated to that in some ways. And I didn't want that. I wanted to build the stage and let other people perform on it. And so so when I started, I realized it was a team sport. So I wanted to bring different disciplines together and go attack the problems for that with that multidisciplinary team. And what it turned out was it really was quite exciting how you could get to new new ideas that have never been thought of before because these talents had never been in a mashup together, right? So you take a business person and an anthropologist and a philosopher and an opera singer and find whoever you can find in that way. And when they built, if you could get them, so design thinking is this methodology that we use, and it's human enough that they would build on each other's ideas as opposed to just fight with each other and leave in a huff, you know, which is what was going on before in multidisciplinary things. But for some reason, this human-centered approach allowed different disciplines of people to come together, and then they started building on each other's ideas. And one would have an idea, and the other one would think, that's not a very good idea. But instead of, like, tearing them down, which they had done before, they said, the next thing that comes out of my mind will be something that fixes the problem that I had the insight that was wrong. And then the follow the tree when you have these different disciplines together is really, really exciting because you go to new places. You just do, right?
There are probably some people listening who don't know exactly what IDEO does, or they don't know what it's like to be in the office working on a project. Pick a project maybe that gives a sense of how you work, how you approach something, and what comes out at the end.
Yeah. So, so we're in San Francisco. Let's do San Francisco Unified School District. San Francisco Unified School District hires us to look at a bunch of stuff, and we end up looking at lunch. I mean, like what a great thing, lunch, you know, for kids, right? And so you go into the cafeteria, and the first thing you notice is that there's hundreds of kids. 53,000 lunches a day are served here. You go into this kind of gymnasium-like space, and the kids are running around screaming, and the adults are all screaming, "Shut up, be quiet!" You know, like what a dumb thing. I mean, like you can't get kids. I mean, you don't put kids in a gym and then tell them to be quiet. You know, like, so you can already see they got the wrong thing going, right? The wrong attitude going. Anyway, so you go in and you observe for a while, and you start to see, and pretty soon you figure out with our human factors mindset, with our, you know, this observation and interview. So you interview everybody, all the stakeholders you do. You interview the principal and you interview the people who give the food out and the kids. And
what are those interviews like? What do you ask them?
Well, you ask them questions that lead you to what they value. You know, you say, you know, like, what's your favorite part of lunch and stuff? And you start to see, well, first you realize nobody's asked the kids pretty quickly. But first thing the kids say is, you know, I think the solution here is ice cream all the time. You know, if you just started serving ice cream from the minute we get in here to the time we leave, that would be perfect.
Right? I'm not sure they're wrong.
Yeah, right. Anyway, so you interview all the stakeholders, and then you watch, and pretty soon you realize... we call this need finding, and the act of figuring out what's worth working on is wildly, in my opinion, more creative than the actual problem solving, because we always talk about problem solving. But I think, especially as a U.S., we're very good at problem solving, but not so good at what problem is worth working on. So if you watch kids at lunch, pretty quickly you realize lunch is not about food for them. Lunch is about socialization. I mean, you've just been on all these classes with a bunch of people, and now is a chance to be with your friends because they come from all over the school, right? I can be with my friends. And so you waste a lot of time standing in line, getting your food and stuff, and it's not about food for them. So now you realize that you want to you want to design an extraordinary experience for them about being with their friends, not an extraordinary experience about lunch, because they don't care about that. I mean, some large percentage of kids don't eat lunch because they want to be with their friends, they want to avoid that. Or, you know, the stigma of, you know, that they, you know, that they're on some food program, whatever. There's all kinds of reasons that they don't eat lunch. And so what happens is we figure out that once you do that, then it's pretty clear what to do. Don't let them stand in line. Bring out the people from behind the counters that are serving lunch. Make lunch a kind of a family-style thing, so when the kids come in, they can sit down at a table right away and start enjoying their friendships of their friends, and then being with their friends, and then we'll have those people serve family-style. But here's the big win. We serve the fruits and vegetables first. They're hungry. There's nothing else on the table. They eat the fruits and vegetables. Like this. I mean, the federally mandated thing is you only have to get the fruits and vegetables on their plates. They don't eat them necessarily. So that's a big win. But the thing I have to say is that with this human-centered approach, you uncover all kinds of very human things. And in this case, the team standing there and they're watching a young kid putting food in his backpack, and that's not you're not allowed to do that in this public school. And so the teacher goes up and says, "You know, I'm sorry. What do you do when you can't?" And he says, "My mother's hungry." So it's really cool. So now we have a project, which is, you know, dinners that you in the federally thing where dinners you can take home. You know, we haven't done this yet, but I mean, the idea is that, you know, there's a bunch of these brown boxes that if you kind of either you pay for it or you're eligible from some federal thing that you can take food home to the family at night. So it's pretty exciting.
And you would think if you hear about a project like that, you would think it's nothing like designing a product or working with Apple or any of these other things. But it's a similar methodology.
It's exactly the same. You try to understand what people value. You know, what's a need that people really have. And then what you do is you just prototype. I mean, our methodology is really what we call bias towards action, which is not, you know, there's not a lot of planning and sitting around. You know those meetings where you sit in the room with everybody's got their laptops open and it just lasts forever and you don't seem to get anything done and then you come back and do that again next week? You know, I mean, like, we just don't think that's a high value. Eventually, planning's good, but only after you've really kind of understand what the issues are. And so whether it's designing a computer or a wastebasket or, you know, we're doing a lot in K-12 education, the way to succeed and the way to kind of get the kind of best ideas is to paint a picture of the future with your idea. However half-baked or however crazy it is, you paint a picture of the future with that in through models or some kind of prototype or making a video or whatever, and then as humans, we're really good at telling people what's wrong with their idea, right? So you just use that human trait, and you start showing it to everybody you can. This is, I think the cars are going to come to your house and pick you up rather than you driving them, you know, or whatever your idea is. And you make that tangible, so visual, so they can tell that's the design part. And then they tell you what's wrong with it, and you take copious notes, and then you decide whether they're right or not and what they do, and you make another prototype, and you make another prototype. I'll tell you one of my best stories about this was kindergartners. So working with kindergartners, and we just give them a project. It's all about project-based learning, so it's that they have a project, and then we can get all the content, whether it's math or, you know, whatever it is. We can, like, once we get them hooked on the project, we can teach them anything. And so we're asking them to design their bedroom, you know. And so they make little cardboard models, and they bring them in. They're super cute and fun.
So you bring in, like, art supplies and stuff.
We fill the room with – there's a place in San Jose called Raft that has just junk that you – for school teachers. We just fill the room with stuff, and they go – anyway, and so, you know, but the trick there is to give them the same, the educational part is to give, nobody seems to have time for this, but it's to give the same project over and over again, because you're becoming more expert. You've seen what the other kids in the class is doing. And we call this guided mastery, where we hold your hand and we make you successful, you know, over and over again. And pretty soon you own your creativity, right? And so, anyway, so the long story, but the girl, one of the girls brings in this thing. She's got this big space next to her bed and this thing. And what's this? And she said, well, in my interviews, I figured out that my big problem is that when I come home, when we come home late, Dad has to carry me all the way from the garage to my bed. So in my bedroom, there's a place where the family car pulls right up next to my bed. You open the door, and I roll out into the bed. So these kids are not stupid. So in the next round, every kid in the class had that. I think that's called the dominant design.
You're listening to design firm IDEO founder David Kelly, whose book is Creative Confidence. He's joined in conversation by Douglas McGray on Bina, a series featuring creative voices from the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org.
Did you grow up in a creative household? Were you a creative little kid?
No, not particularly. I grew up in Ohio in a working class family. You know, nothing kind of ever happened. You know, very traditional. But I'd say, you know, in the book we dedicate the book to my parents. And I think what they did was they didn't discourage us. You know, it was like benign neglect or something. You know, I don't know about that. You know, like. They would know where we were, you know, like before bedtime, but they had no idea where we were the rest of the day. Anyway, so that freedom, I think there was nobody saying you can't do that or that won't work or you know don't do that. There was none of that. So my mother tells lots of stories about how stuff like the piano got taken apart but never put back together.
Yeah, you mentioned in the book that you lived, you shared a room with your brother for 14 years. It seemed to me that might be good preparation for writing a book with him.
I think the book might be the hardest thing we ever did together, to tell you the truth. Yeah. I'm very close to my brother. It's a lovely thing. He works in the company. So if you're the CEO of the company or the founder of the company, it's really nice when you leave that your brother's still there, you know, to make sure things still happen. But, when 2000, I talk about in the book, in 2007, I was diagnosed with throat cancer. And, you know, it was pretty nasty. I mean, you know, they said I had 40% chance to live or something. And it was, you know, I lost 50 pounds and it was a big mess. And the end of that story is I survived. Just, you know, see you. I'll skip. I'll skip to the end there, but anyway. So, my brother was there basically every day for me, and so when it was clear that I was going to survive, we decided we would do overt rather because we kind of divide and conquer and weren't doing many things together in the company. So we decided we would travel together and we'd do a project together. So we traveled. It was lovely, mostly in Japan. And just, you know, two of us, and it was lovely right after I got over the cancer stuff. And then the project we decided to do was the book. And so that book is the, you know, our jointly thing. He's much more of a writer than I am. I'm more of a kind of, you know, I'd rather, you know, build the Taj Mahal out of toothpicks than to write a paragraph. But we would get in the morning and we'd like brainstorm, and I do these things called mind maps. Mm-hmm. It's like the equivalent of a list for a kind of a creative person. And so I make these mind maps.
What does it look like?
It looks like a tree. It looks like a diagram. You take the basis premise that you're trying to work on, chapter 7's whatever title or whatever is, and then you start going out and recording like the ideas you have going out from the center, and you draw them little bubbles and stuff. What happens is that all those ideas that you have like off the top of your head in the first kind of half hour are all very cliched and anybody could come up with them. But what you do is you force yourself, given that inspiration of that branch of the tree, to push yourself further. You keep asking yourself why what it says. They say why, and you just keep going further out, and you eventually get to each of the branches away from the center. You get to a place that you hadn't been before in your own mind, right? And that's what's that's powerful about it. So we would do that, and then he would convert those to ideas, and then write them basically.
And when you were doing this, I'm sure it reflected a lot of the idea generation that you would have at IDEO.
Just like normal IDEO boards on any subject.
Yeah. But then the thing I was curious about is you've been brothers longer, obviously. Were there ways and were there times that broke the system down, that sort of being brothers, you had to alter the way you do things a bit?
Yeah, I mean, one thing is about brothers in that situation, you accept them, you accept each other for what you are, you know, dysfunction and all, right? So one of the problems I have in life is somebody I don't like the way they do something, every time it's like a movie, and every time they enter the screen, I punish them for them being who they are, right? I mean, like, this is the evil guy. You know he's the evil guy. Why are you upset that he's the evil guy? He's already been cast as the evil guy, right? So, And so that's hard because you kind of, well, in the case of brothers in this case, we know each other's weaknesses. So you just, you know, like I can see something coming that he's going to start being down in the mouth about. And I just like drive by that on purpose, you know, go some other place. So yeah, it's a very positive thing if you can get that positive thing going. I assume it's any place where there's that much emotion, it could spiral down the other way just as easily but we didn't have that situation. But partly it has to do with working so long, and I'm the older brother, so, you know, like, he's probably better at compromise than I am.
If you're writing a book about creativity, it's a big challenge. And one of the points that you make in the book is that people have a pretty wrong idea about what creativity is and how it works. I mean, what's the vision of creativity that you want people to take away?
Well, the main thing the book's about is that trying to convince everybody that they're wildly creative. You know, when I started the D School at Stanford, I thought we might have to teach creativity. And every year 800 students come through the place, and it's been going since 2005. Turns out we just have to unblock the things that are in their way. They're still wildly creative. What happens is, from our research, is that sometime about 9 years old, when you start being aware that other people are noticing, you know, you, before that you're completely open loop. I love kids where, you know, like there's no fear, no concern about what other people think. You know, you just scream loudly at, you know, whatever you want to, right? And so at some point, though, somebody convinces them that they're not creative and they opt out of creativity.
And why do you think it takes at that age? What is it that makes that message stick at that point?
I think because they're starting to be self-aware and they're looking for who they are, and you tell them you can't play the piano, even though, I mean, you can't walk up to the piano and play it for the first time. But I don't know this for sure, I haven't studied this exactly, but it has something to do with art. Like, they're saying you're not artistic, which is probably true. And the kid takes that as you're not creative, and then they opt out of it, right? And then they go in a path where since they opt out of it, they don't do it. You know, they don't try. And by the time they get to me in college, it's pretty ingrained that I'm an analytical person. I'm a doctor. I'm a lawyer. I'm an engineer. You know, I'm not a creative person. In fact, ad agency do us a real disservice by saying that they divide the company into the creatives and the not creatives. You know, I mean that's not helping. What we find though is, if you can get somebody and you can, through projects, you can get them to see, we call this guided mastery, and we give them a small project and they help them be successful, and then a bigger one, and then a team project, and a really different, we just up the complexity, and eventually they say, oh my God, I'm a creative person, or my team is a creative thing. So the way I got on this was, there's a professor at Stanford called Albert Bandura. If you're a psychology major, you know who the hell Albert Bandura is. Bandura, if you look at Wikipedia, they say Bandura is the fourth most important psychologist in history. You know, Freud, Skinner, Bandura there. And so he believes that this guided mastery is the way to unlock, to block, to stop people's fears. So his research is like snake phobias and spider phobias and stuff. And he holds the people's hands, take them through like a lot of small things. And he basically can move these people from not going outside because there might be a snake out there to, like, you know, being totally cured in a very short period of time. And it's exactly what we do. It's like, I'm dealing with the fear of being judged. Mostly people don't do creative things or live creative lives because they're afraid of being judged, right? He's got the fear of snakes. I mean, pretty tangible. But his success, he shows how once they've broken this fear and they've moved to what he calls self-efficacy, which is similar to creative confidence, it changes everything in their life. They have more stick to it. They make better decisions about what they need to do in life. They you know, in the face of failure, they're more resilient. Like, it's pretty cathartic, and we see that in the students over and over again, that once you've broken that I'm not creative into this confident place of self-efficacy, it changes a lot in their life. They change professions, and they change their direction, and they make a pivot in their lives.
And when did you start?
I sound like Tony Robbins sometimes.
When did you start thinking about this? Was it working with people at IDEO? Was it working with clients? Was it later at the university?
To tell you the truth, the way I got to this was I was watching people who were insecure. There were people who were high performers. I mean, we were talking about this backstage. You've got a new venture and trying to understand how to hire people and, like, hiring the right people and empowering them and stuff. And I noticed that people who were perfectly, effective at what they were doing, if something in the culture made them insecure, they started to act badly. I mean, that insecurity caused them to do things that if you looked at, they were actually bad for them and the company. It's like the football game where a guy punches a guy and then he turns around and hits him and they catch the second guy punching him, you know? And so I was trying to understand why this being insecure was so debilitating, right? And so if you go there, then you start to understand the confident. And you look at overly confident people. And so I was in this thing of the tension between being insecure and being overly confident, right? And so that's how the term creative confidence came up, was watching that. And then I realized that it applied to everything we did, you know, that not just the employees, but the clients and my students and everybody.
Mm-hmm. And you give some tips in the book, and some of them I think would be hard for people at first. You know, you talk about being sloppy and making a lot of stuff.
Yeah.
Talk about that at IDEO. How does that factor into the work?
Yeah. Well, this notion, you know, like, I love these things that say, you know, you should learn to fail. Fail's good. I'm thinking, whoa, we don't want to fail, especially at the end. I mean, you might want to fail at the beginning a little bit, but failing at the end, ooh, that's not good. It reminds me that, so I have a good friend named John Cassidy. We call him Cass, and he started a company called Klutz Press. You remember Klutz Press, right? Klutz Press. If you have kids, you probably bought, you know, a book that has, you know, face paint tied to it or something. Anyways, so John, when he started out, was... His first book was called Juggling for the Complete Klutz. That was his first book. And it's a funny story because he thought he was in the juggling business, so his next five books were unsuccessful because they were about juggling. And then he figured out he was in the book business, and wild success, sold to Scholastic and stuff. But in his book, Juggling for the Complete Klutz, he figured out that the whole problem with juggling was about confidence. It was about your fear that the ball was going to hit the floor was debilitating. You know, you know that there's no consequence to the ball hitting the floor, yet your brain can't shut off that that's a horrible thing. You know, the ball dropping is not good. I have my phobia about, like, missing the plane at the airport. I like flying, but, like, there's no consequence. Like, I just take the next plane, but my brain won't shut off, like, torturing me about how I'm going to be late for the plane. I really call these bird walks, where I walk off into something that has nothing to do with the talk. I'm sorry. And you'll have to bring me back. I think we're talking about
juggling. Hitting the floor.
Anyway, and so it turns out that once you spend enough time dropping the ball and desensitizing your brain to dropping the ball, you can juggle easily. I mean, really easily. It's really interesting to watch how that happens. And it's great, you know, because you can impress the girls at parties, pick up the oranges, you know, and but that's the essence of what it is that that fear of being of dropping the ball, that fear of being judged by others, right? And so if you have a culture like IDEO where that's celebrated, I mean, IDEO celebrates how risk-taking can you be and not get caught, you know, like how you know, when you're supposed to do a certain job, how like extreme can you do it? How extraordinarily can you do it, you know, without, I don't mean like getting caught by the boss, there's not, but I mean like within the constraints of what's reasonable or sustainable in the world, right? Can you do that? And so the world's kind of, the present world is like, people are trying to kind of stay in the middle mostly and not take a risk, and we should be punishing that inactivity. That's what's kind of grind the whole thing to a halt. And we should be rewarding people who are, you know, trying stuff with, you know, not just wild stuff, but that are pushing stuff. And so I spend a lot of time with CEOs and trying to get the bosses of these companies, instead of when a young designer, a young you know, marketing person, what gets to see the boss, the CEO, they polish their things to the, you know, like they try to make it perfect, you know, stuff. And then the boss can only say this is yes or no, right? Whereas, so that's the boss's problem, not the person's problem. So you got to get the bosses to expect kind of half-baked, multiple, show me three ideas, you know, one completely crazy, you know, like show me a bunch of stuff, and I'll help you kind of navigate what you should spend your time on in the next round. So I can really seem to, we can certainly make a lot of progress if we can get the boss, instead of like one big cycle where you show the boss your final product, or the users for that matter, not just the boss, right, the customers, that you show a bunch of kind of half-baked ideas and iterate. So we show the idea, we improve upon it, we improve upon it, improve upon it, improve upon it. So in a culture where the senior manager, the management of the company is looking for this iterative, you know, improvement through iteration in short bursts rather than one long cycle, seems to be the way that correlates, that allows this kind of stuff to happen. You have to be open-minded as well, but that seems to be the key.
Well, one tool that you mentioned is bringing a marker into the shower. I'm not sure that would fly at every household.
This is not a pretty picture. but yeah, no, so this is a concept called relaxed attention. It turns out that seems like you have your best ideas, not when you're asleep. I mean, I know you should, you know, my brother thinks you wake up in the morning and you write your best ideas down. I think that's a possibility for some people. We only have our own experience. But my belief is this relaxed attention. When you're not like trying real hard, but when you're not asleep, but you're paying attention. You know, that state, it's kind of a, I'm sure there's something in Buddhism that, I mean, I just don't know Buddhism, but I mean, I'm sure there's something in it that relates to it. In that moment. So for me, I seem to have my best ideas in the shower. So I have a big, you know, whiteboard in my shower where I write the stuff down. The sad part of this is sometimes I forget and I have to send my secretary back to my shower to like copy down what I wrote earlier this morning.
This is Bina, KALW series featuring artists and thinkers who've spoken at the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. Today's program features design firm IDEO founder David Kelly, whose book is Creative Confidence. He's joined in conversation by Douglas McGray. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org.
The other tool, the work seems to involve a lot of Post-its.
We should get some kickback from 3M, I think.
There's a scene in the book where there are four IDEO people in a car, and they're either about to run out of Post-its or they've run out of Post-its, and it kind of takes on the quality of being in the desert and running out of food and water.
Yeah.
What will happen next?
Yeah.
Explain the Post-its.
Yeah, so our way of coming up with ideas is collaborative and... as I said, it's a team sport. So the opposite of this is one person speaks and they say they're all our ideas, and then the next person speaks, and the next person. That's not a build on each other's ideas kind of frame. So how do you, when it's all happening at the same time, how do you orchestrate that? And we do that with Post-its. So I have an idea. You're talking about your idea. I write my idea on a Post-it so I don't forget it. And then when there's a break in the action, I haven't forgotten it, and it's not exactly my turn, but there's a break in the action, so I can then get my Post-it out and put it out. So it's a way of recording asynchronously, like your ideas, so that in the fray of everybody coming up with ideas, there it's the placeholder, so that you know that it can happen. So when you watch, it's pretty interesting ballet because you know your people have different personality types and different quality ideas, and so. It's really, it's just the way that we get all the ideas. You know, I think Linus Pauling said, if you want a good idea, have lots of ideas. And so it's a way to flood the subject with ideas without slowing down the pace. Somehow, if you have a culture where somebody in the group gets rewarded for being so smart as to tell you what's wrong with the idea, then that kind of slows the train down, right? The whole process. So and a lot of cultures are like that, where somebody says an idea that's kind of half-baked, and the other person says, you know, that's not going to work because this won't work, you know, this is stuff, and there's not that many, right? And that's just not helpful, right? I mean, it may be true, but it's not helpful. And so the whole markers and Post-its, and at the D-School or IDEO, you can't walk 15 feet without finding a box full of Post-its and a Sharpie, you know, because that's the way we work. Oh, the other thing about that is that now you have this board, we put it on these big boards, and now when the brainstorm's over and stuff, you walk off with the board and you have all the ideas written down, as opposed to in a verbal thing, something gets lost. So the writing them down and drawing little pictures on the Post-it notes is also a way to record them, because we want to go back and, you know, because you go down this path and it doesn't work. What other ideas did we have, right? And they're right there. They're recorded.
And so at the D School, it's a whole educational initiative built up around these sorts of ideas. Explain a little bit how it works there. Maybe sure. Talk about a class. I heard there was a class that's actually about Stanford, which I think is totally fascinating.
At Stanford, yeah. There's a class on Carol Shorenstein Hayes funded the future of theater. We did that last quarter. And the classes are all over. I don't actually care what the classes are. I'm trying to teach the students to be mindful of process and be creatively confident. And so I just try to feed them projects that turn them on, and then we can teach them. Once you're working on a project you care about, then it's easier to learn the things. But so the D-School is an interesting place because it's an opt-in culture. The reason it's taken off is that everybody's there because they want to be. It's hard to understand that if you're a university professor and I teach required classes and people are there because they have to be, that's a completely different thing. And at the D School, there's none of those. I don't pay the professors. So and then there's, you know, 50 of them or 100 of them, you know, Stanford professors that are world class or whatever they do. But they come there because of the students, because that excitement of those students being turned on in the way they do. So if they want to come, they either have to overload the class or they have to get their department to say, this is one of your classes now, you know, which was hard in the beginning. The students don't get degrees. Half the classes are not for credit. So everybody's there because they want to be there, right? And that's a really different educational experience. So the way a class works is just like an IDEO project where we let the students do need finding and let them pick the project. Completely different, again, than your project being assigned. So they go out, they look around, they do need finding, and they come back and say something in their world usually, and they say, I want to improve the experience of taking the train from Palo Alto to San Francisco. So that's their project, right? And then, you know, they recruit teams from other students. We're really lucky that, you know, hundreds of students want to take every class, and we only have room for 40 or 50 in each class. So there's a big pool to draw on. They, you know, if you need a coder, or you need a mechanical engineer, or you need a business person, and they pull them all together, the team that's come up with the idea, and they and then they just go out and start prototyping. And we have classes where It's, so Stanford's on quarter system, so it's 10 weeks long. We have classes like Launchpad where you have to have your idea in customers' hands in 5 weeks, halfway through the quarter.
And that's actually starting a company?
Yeah. Yeah, in effect. So, and we, I can tell you stories, you know, like the best iPad app, pad selling app of two guys that started in this class, and they just sold their company to LinkedIn for $90 million. And we have students who have built the projects that are saving 50,000 lives a year because they make this kind of incubator, like more like a sleeping bag that keeps babies, you know, who are, have trouble maintaining their weight.
Yeah,
you know.
explain that one. I thought Embrace. That was a really interesting project, yeah.
Embrace. So Embrace is, comes out, like I said, we have 26 classes a quarter at Stanford, 800 students here. The Embrace class is in a class called Extreme Affordability, or just Extreme if you're an insider. And it's a two-quarter course. Again, students from all over the university, from all kinds of different departments, they come together, and the professors are, that's the hard part, the professors are from different parts, and they really have trouble getting along, because
well, that's not what universities are for. Professors talking to professors.
Yeah, their professors are like winning Nobel Prizes and going really deep. They're not supposed to talk to anybody else. But anyway, so we've broken that mold, and they're there. So Embrace. So Embrace goes out. In fact, there's a... PBS special about Embrace that's just out. I got Ralph King, I forget what it's called, but it's been on PBS, and it follows one of the teams. The funny thing about journalism I didn't understand was they had to pick which team to follow. They didn't know which team was going to be good, right? They had to follow a team, right? So it was pretty interesting. And so they go out, and they're looking at hospitals, and they see incubators, and they get fascinated with incubators. And... one of the things that fascinates them is these incubators cost about 20, they're in India, and one of these incubators costs about $20,000 a piece, and they're empty. So they got a few incubators, they're empty. Yet there's close to 1 million babies a year dying, right, that could use an incubator. So what's the deal? Well, anyways, our need finding, you know, reframe the problem. They go away from incubators to, like, how do you keep these babies alive in the, you know, out the remote villages, right? And so you go there and, anyways, make a long story short, these kids who were going to take perfectly good jobs as McKinsey partners and other things, you know, as Stanford people do, they quit their jobs and they decide this is too important. And so they start doing this thing that's basically, it's called, it's a, like a sleeping bag that has a paraffin in it, and you heat it under hot water. And then it turns out that the babies, you know, who have this low birth weight, if you can keep them warm for the first X number of months of their lives, they survive, right? And so I think they just passed 50,000 babies. They saved 50,000 lives so far. But it's just a bunch of Stanford students that, you know, quit their jobs and said this is important. But it's the feeling that they have of that kind of bravado of we did this, you know, like it wasn't clear where to go, it wasn't obvious, and we just stuck with it and moved to India. I just saw a couple of them come back, which is a hardship in itself, and we're doing this, and so lots of prototypes. They had a bunch of, you know, like I saw all the prototypes, you know, this thing that's you know, kind of made out of plastic, it didn't work, and this thing, and I'll tell you one story. So when they first started out, I mean, you can't improve these products or any services without the kind of visceral being there and trying them out. So if you just kind of think you're so smart that you can come up with the product, that's a really bad way to go. And so they do these products, and so that's really cool. So the product comes out, and it's got this thermometer on it so that you can figure out how much to... how hot to make the thing before you put the baby, safe for the baby. So they go out and it says, you know, heat this, and they got this thermometer, it says heat to 100 degrees. I think it's 100 degrees. Heat to 100 degrees, whatever it says. And they go back and they're not working. And they go back and all this observation, they go back into the field and they're not working, they can't figure it out. And it turns out, so they finally figure it out. The woman says to them, yeah, well, Western medicine is so powerful that I only heat it up to 70 degrees. They said 100, but Western medicine is so powerful that I don't want to risk it, so I only heat it to 70 degrees, which is not enough, right? So it's really easy to do on the product. You just change where it says 100, you write okay instead of 100, and say, heat it up until it's okay.
When you look back at the beginning of your career at early IDEO, and you were already on this path, but without the experience that you have now, what were the things that you didn't understand yet then?
What do you mean?
About this methodology. What were I'm sure it became refined over time, and yeah, you discovered things. What hadn't you figured out yet at that point?
Well, I really hadn't figured out. So I was an engineer, right?
Yeah.
So I hadn't figured out the power of this. As an engineer, it was kind of messy to go into people's homes or to convene a bunch of people who cared about this. We're redesigning the experience in Kaiser Hospital and like going in there and talking to the nurses and hearing about all things that are wrong in their lives. And, you know, it's just like, it's messy, right? And so, I didn't really understand the power of really feeling the empathy for the person you're trying to solve. Once you get over that line, I mean, you can't stop these teams once they, you know, you meet, we're doing a big project in Peru for the kids. If you go there and spend some time with the Peruvian kids and see how bad their education is, you can't help yourself, right? The motivation doesn't come from, I don't see it ever come from making money or like coming up with cool ideas of products and stuff. The most powerful motivation for all these teams comes from empathy for these people. And how can we do something that's going to actually impact them? Right?
I mean, for people who are listening and wondering, am I a creative person? Is he talking about me? What are some things that they can explore that part?
Well, they are a creative person, but unfortunately, I'm not sure even reading this silly book is going to help you. you have to take action, right? I think it's the same question as how do you get on a diet? You know, I mean, it's the same question as where do you find the wherewithal to do something differently? I can tell you one thing that's really worked for us. In the book, there's a discussion about double delivering. So you're in a company and, you know, I get so many letters from people. I work in this lumbering company in Midwestern United States and, you know, my boss is never going to let me do this. And, you know, like it's helpless, hopeless and stuff. So, but they write that the concept of double delivering has worked, which is you have a problem. You have to do it the way the boss wants it. You have he or she has expectations and you have to decide to deliver on those expectations or it's not going to help you with your career, right? So you have to do that. But you're a young person and you're eager and stuff. Then you use some of the methods we talk about by going out and meeting users and building a prototype. I mean, and then you kind of double deliver. So you deliver in the way they're expecting and you have this other thing. And they report that they go to meetings with prototypes and everybody else has got a yellow pad with a pencil and they have a prototype and the whole meeting is about their prototype once they show up, right? Because they've done that. And so so I think there are ways to lower the risk. You don't risk your career and you try some of this stuff and pretty soon the company starts to notice that you're like more creative than the average bear. And not that they give you a better job, but like you start to get little projects. You know, you throw the holiday party because you're such a creative person. You should, you know, have ideas. And pretty soon, after they give you a bunch of projects that are not core to the company, then they end up, a lot of them end up moving into positions where they're doing creative work.
Well, I'm sure people in the audience have questions. It would be great to give them a chance to ask some.
Simple and quick. What size Post-its do you use?
We use. Where's Christine? Right there. 4x4, 3x3.
3x3, and then the rectangle.
3x3. Good question.
Hi, thanks. So a lot of the great examples you gave have to do with the physical or tangible experiences. Do your techniques differ for more software-based experiences?
No, I mean, again, I'm going to sound like I'm, you know, like this is my religion or something, and I believe it works on everything. I mean, I'm not thinking it'd work in politics, for instance. Of course, what would work in politics, I don't know. But we do lots of, we have a digital lab, we do lots of digital stuff. Our stuff works the best when there's a human in the loop that their desires or their what's valuable to them is not understood, or that there's a new way of looking at what's important to them that results in innovation. So it really doesn't matter what it is. So, you know, we look at, checking into the Mayo Clinic or checking into the to the Marriott Hotel, or, you know, a piece of software that's for kids. Oh, I got to tell that story. So one of my favorite projects at IDEO is called Elmo's Calling. I don't know if you know this product. If you have kids Sesame Street age, you might know it. But we noticed that kids that... So you're looking for funny behavior. So one of the things we noticed, we watched and we were observing something else. We noticed that parents are handing their young kid, 2-3-year-old kids, this very expensive device to babysit them, like on airplanes and stuff. And like, that's really weird behavior. You don't give, you wouldn't give your kid like the Ming vase to play with, right? So why are you giving them this thing? Anyways, and so we got that. And so we started that. We have lots of apps for this. We have a big relationship with Sesame Street and we jointly develop apps. But this is really still on topic, believe it or not. Software. So we designed an app for Sesame Street called Elmo's Calling. Best-selling app in this, you know, hundreds, millions of downloads for Elmo. So here's how it goes. Your kid's there, crying, needs to be entertained. You hand him your cell phone. A few seconds later, the phone rings. And there's a little picture of a phone, and you answer it, and it's Elmo. And it's FaceTime. So you're the little picture at the bottom, and then Elmo's picture. And you could see the look on the kid's face. Elmo's calling me? Right? Here's what makes the app the bestseller. The parent can program the app so that Elmo's talking about stuff like bedtime or eating or potty training. Right? Anyway, so we think if it applies to Elmo, it's got to apply to everything. You know,
so there you go, ladies and gentlemen. Please join me in thanking David Kelly. Okay. Thank you so much for coming.
Bina is a co-production of the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco and KALW. For more information about programs at the JCCSF, you can visit jccsf.org. Today's guest was design firm IDEO founder David Kelly, whose book is Creative Confidence. He was joined in conversation by Douglas McGray. The recording engineers at the JCCSF are Ben Bernardi, Brandon Battaglia, Dan Folds, Alex Espalay, and Lincoln Andrews. David Kwan edits and produces the program, and Matt Martin is the executive producer. Our theme music is from the album Masada Rock by the Rasha Neem Trio, and the music you're hearing right now is by John Zorn. Bina is available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org. I'm Jordan Abel. Thanks for listening.